90.3 FM.
In the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
New York, this is Democracy Now!
The bare minimum is to establish humanitarian corridors where people can get out and humanitarian aid can get in. Any attack on civilians is a violation of international law, is a war crime.
As Russia escalates its attack on Ukraine, NATO is calling on Russia to halt attacks on civilians. The United Nations says more than 2.5 million people have now fled Ukraine over the past 15 days. We'll speak with a leading Ukrainian environmental lawyer from the western city of Ivano-Frankivsk, which was just bombed today. She just co-wrote a piece titled, "The Ukraine War is a Decision Point. Banks should stop funding the fossil fuel industry forever." Then we go to the besieged southern Ukrainian city of Mykolaiv.
The situation is not very good because every day there are artillery working on against our city. Like they bomb civilian houses where people live.
We'll also talk to retired Colonel Andrew Basevich, president and co-founder of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He says the United States cannot absolve itself of responsibility for the catastrophe in Ukraine. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's withering assault on Ukraine has entered its 16th day. New satellite images show a column of Russian tanks and armored vehicles has dispersed north of Kyiv for a possible ground assault on the capital. Earlier today, Russian airstrikes hit the city of Dnipro in central eastern Ukraine, killing at least one person. The airstrikes reportedly hit a kindergarten, an apartment building, and a shoe factory. Long-range Russian missiles also hit airfields in two western cities. Some 400,000 people remain trapped by Russian forces in the besieged city of Mariupol. People said they've endured near-constant artillery attacks amidst freezing temperatures with no heat, electricity or communications, food and water in short supply.
There's nothing here. It's the first time that we've got bread and food here. There was nothing before. It's the first day. There's no information, no electricity. It's just the vacuum.
My children are in Mariupol and near Kyiv. I don't know. There is no mobile connection so far, so we can't get in touch. For 2 weeks, we don't know what is up with them and where they are, our children. It's very scary.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his government's working to secure humanitarian corridors for civilians trapped by fighting. He said Russian forces targeted an evacuation route Thursday in southeastern Ukraine.
Today, they destroyed the building of the main department of the State Emergency Service in the Donetsk region. Right next to this building was the place where Mariupol residents were to gather for evacuation. This is outright terror, blatant terror, from experienced terrorists.
The UN's nuclear watchdog says the situation at the former Chernobyl nuclear power plant's deteriorating. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it lost contact with staff working under Russian guard at the site of the 1986 nuclear disaster after power was cut Wednesday. Ukrainian officials say operators have been forced to use backup diesel generators to power cooling systems that are needed to prevent a radioactive release. The IAEA says 210 technical staff and guards have not not been allowed to rotate off shift or rest since Russian forces seized Chernobyl 2 weeks ago. The International Atomic Energy Agency also says it was no longer receiving remote data transmissions from safety monitoring systems at Chernobyl, as well as the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. On Thursday, IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi held talks in Turkey with foreign ministers of Ukraine and Russia, urging them to reach a deal on the safety and security of Ukraine's nuclear sites.
Perhaps the gravity of my tone has to do with the gravity of the situation, because it's a very dire situation, and we need to move fast.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say Russian warplanes bombed a physics institute in the eastern city of Kharkiv, which houses an experimental nuclear reactor. After headlines, we'll go to Ukraine for the latest. The White House says President Biden will ask Congress to revoke most favored nation trade status for Russia. Russian leaders hit back, ordering an export ban on more than 200 products until the end of the year. A top Kremlin official said Russia may respond by seizing the assets of foreign companies and nationalizing their Russian operations. Economists believe Russia could see a 15% decline in its gross domestic product this year as a result of sanctions. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said on Thursday, accused the United States and its allies of waging an economic war on Russia. Meanwhile, the World Bank's chief economist is warning the Ukraine crisis will lead to soaring food and fuel prices and could trigger widespread hunger and social unrest, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, which are highly dependent on imports of Russian and Ukrainian commodities like wheat and cooking oil. The Biden administration reports inflation has risen to a level not seen since 1982. The Labor Department said Thursday the consumer price index rose by 7.9% over the 12-month period that ended February. At the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Thursday U.S. residents should expect more inflationary pressure in the weeks ahead as bans on Russian fossil fuels squeeze energy markets.
In terms of prices going up, we do anticipate that gas prices and energy prices will go up. That is something that the president has conveyed very clearly to the American public. We also believe it will be temporary and not long-lasting.
The United Arab Emirates says it'll press OPEC to pump more oil after Russia's invasion of Ukraine led to soaring fuel prices. The move's a departure from the UAE's position in recent months in support of higher oil prices that benefited major producers, including Russia and Saudi Arabia. This comes as Biden administration officials have been quietly holding talks with Saudi officials and are reportedly weighing a potential Biden visit to the kingdom to discuss global oil supply. U.S. military commanders have reportedly asked President Biden to station hundreds of commandos in Somalia to counter al-Shabaab. The move would reverse former President Trump's transfer of some 700 U.S. combat forces from bases in Somalia to neighboring countries last January. The Biden administration says North Korea has tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile system capable of delivering a nuclear warhead anywhere on Earth. North Korean media reports the recent launches were related to plans by leader Kim Jong-un to launch spy satellites into orbit to monitor the militaries of the United States and its allies. A Pentagon spokesperson rejected those claims, saying North Korea is instead preparing a test of a new ICBM at full range, disguised as a space launch. Israeli legislators passed a law Thursday that denies citizenship rights to Palestinians from the occupied West Bank or Gaza who are married to Israelis. A similar measure had already been in place since 2003 but expired last year. Critics call it a racist law that singles out Arabs and forces thousands of families to move or live apart. In other news from Israel, authorities raided and arrested French-Palestinian activist and lawyer Salah Hamouri. The arrest came one day after Hamouri published an op-ed in Jacobin describing the judicial harassment, as he put it, he and his family have faced for years. In November, researchers revealed Hamouri's phone had been hacked with the powerful Pegasus spyware made by the Israeli firm NSO Group. In India, the ruling Hindu nationalist BJP party has won elections in four key states, including northern Uttar Pradesh, which represents about a fifth of India's population and has more members of parliament than any other state. The results are a boon for Prime Minister Narendra Modi ahead of national elections in 2024. Uttar Pradesh's chief minister is Yogi Adityanath, a Hindu monk who's made anti-Muslim statements. Critics warn he's allowed for the police killing of Dalits and Muslims in the state, as well as a crackdown on journalists and activists. In a surprise reversal, Guatemala's conservative president Alejandro Giammattei came out against a recently passed bill increasing penalties for abortions and banning same-sex marriage.
I have decided that if that law reaches my office, it will be vetoed. It violates two conventions to which Guatemala is a signatory. Its wording has technical deficiencies, and furthermore, it violates the Republic's political constitution.
Guatemala's Congress had approved the bill Tuesday, International Women's Day. It would have increased prison sentences for people who have an abortion to 10 years. Back in the United States, the Census Bureau reported the Trump administration significantly undercounted Latinx, Black, and Indigenous residents of the United States when it carried out the census in 2020. New data show an estimated 18.8 million people were left out of the most recent census, with communities of color undercounted at far higher rates than in previous censuses. This follows efforts by former President Trump to shorten the 2020 census and to add a citizenship question that rights groups say was aimed at discouraging immigrants from participating. Texas Democratic Congressmember Joaquin Castro tweeted, quote, "This was intentional. The undercount will strip Latino communities of government funding and electoral power. Congress must not allow this to happen again," he said. In a watershed event in the ongoing reckoning over the opioid crisis, victims of the epidemic have directly confronted the Sackler family, owners of Purdue Pharma. In a hearing Thursday as part of Purdue's bankruptcy settlement, 26 people from 19 states shared with the Sacklers the pain and tragedy they and their families face because of addiction to OxyContin. Ryan Hampton, opioid survivor, author, and activist, said, quote, "I hope that every single victim's face haunts your every waking moment and your sleeping ones, too. I hope you hear our names in your dreams. I hope you hear the screams of the families who find their loved ones dead on the bathroom floor. You poisoned our lives and had the audacity to blame us for dying," he said. In labor news, workers at three more Buffalo-area Starbucks voted to unionize. Six U.S.-based Starbucks now have a union. Over 100 other locations around the country have filed for their own union elections. And Major League Baseball has reached an agreement with the MLB Players Association on a new union contract. The deal ends a 99-day lockout of players by team owners that had threatened to shorten the 2022 season. Opening day is now set for April 7th. In a statement, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders wrote, quote, "It would be wrong for Congress to simply celebrate today's agreement and move on. We must prevent the greed of baseball's oligarchs from destroying the game. The best way to do that is to end Major League Baseball's antitrust exemption, and I will be introducing legislation to do just that," Senator Sanders said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's widening its attack on Ukraine as the war enters its 16th day. Earlier today, Russian airstrikes hit the city of Dnipro in central eastern Ukraine, killing at least one person. The airstrikes reportedly hit a kindergarten, an apartment building, and a shoe factory. Long-range Russian missiles also hit airfields in two western cities, in Lutsk and Ivano-Frankivsk. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials are accusing Russia of shelling a physics institute in the eastern city of Kharkiv that houses an experimental nuclear reactor. Satellite images show the Russian convoy outside Kyiv has now dispersed in a sign that Russia may soon move on the capital city. This all comes as the United Nations says more than 2.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country. We begin today's show with the Ukrainian environmental lawyer and climate activist who recently fled Ivano-Frankivsk, one of the western cities
that was just bombed today. Svetlana Romanko is the founder of the Stand With Ukraine campaign, calling on governments to ban trade and investment in Russian oil and gas. This week, she co-authored an article for the Los Angeles Times with Bill McKibben, headlined, "The Ukraine War is a Decision Point. Banks should stop funding the fossil fuel industry forever." Svetlana Romanko, welcome to Democracy Now! Before we talk about this very important piece in your climate work, can you take us on the journey that you have taken? Describe what's happened. We did not know when we were first talking to you that your city would be bombed. Talk about what happened. This is in the west of Ukraine that hasn't been hit yet. And then where you are now, or at least the overall region.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much for having me today and for inviting me and giving a voice and space for Ukrainian activists to share the happenings and share the latest war developments and the huge impact, catastrophic impact that it's making for all our lives continually and gradually and severely, I would say. That's not true that we only have had explosions today in Ivano-Frankivsk, where I am regularly based, and where I do have plan to come back in a few days and continue my fight for justice and for peace for my country, my beloved country. I actually woke up with my family to explosions on February 24th. The first day of war. Before that, we've got a lot of warnings from different intelligence services all over the world that heads up, the Putin is going to attack, just get prepared and just stay strong and hold on. And I can say as a human, as a lawyer as well, because lawyers are normally more prepared to take over some difficulties, challenges, because that's normally what their work is, just to solve some problems in legislation and so on. But we all have been unprepared to wake up to explosions. We all have been highly unprepared to see our people dying, to lose our relatives, to lose a lot of children dying under the bombarded maternity hospitals. This is inhumane. This is insane. And this is atrocities that must stop. For doing even now, when I am speaking to you now, representing Ukrainian climate community, and we are many, we are trying to act. I will tell you a bit more later of how we are organizing and what we are doing, and what is our piece with Bill McKibben about, and why we target those institutions, and how this could help Ukraine, bombarded Ukraine, just bleeding Ukraine, which is suffering every day. Today's it's 16th day of war already, and that has been a very long 16 days for all the world that expressed immense solidarity, which we are deeply grateful for. And it's been a very long days for us, for all Ukrainians. And today, as you said, there were new explosions in new cities. Just again, explosions in Ivano-Frankivsk after 16 days. And what say, fortunately, no victims, no people died in Ivano-Frankivsk, but at least one person, as you said, died in our other city, Dnipro and Lutsk. The tactic of Putin's war machine is to keep civilians in fear, to destroy their infrastructure and buildings, to enable the terror, panic, and to enable Ukrainian government to accept what Ukrainian government will never accept. The conditions which Putin requests us to hold with. Saying that, I would also admit that there are still almost 400,000 people that are staying in Mariupol, where is a huge humanitarian catastrophe. They are starving. They don't have water. The green corridors don't work for them because Russian troops opened fire and killed many civilians.
Yes, we
even understand it. Yeah,
we still don't know how many people have died there, but we've seen the images of the mass graves where scores have been buried because there's no time to bury them individually. But the hearing in Mariupol about the lack of water, the lack of food, the freezing temperatures, and yet there's no electricity, even cell service is cut off.
But, yeah, and
Svetlana, I wanted to read from the piece that you wrote with Bill McKibben. I think clearly, overall, it very much ties into what we're seeing today. You say, above all, it's obvious that the world's banks have amorally worked to build Russia's oil and gas industry, the industry that funds the Russian army, and the industry that Vladimir Putin has used as a cudgel for decades to keep Europe cowering. And that's why we cheered so loudly Tuesday when President Biden, as part of his ban on Russian oil, told American banks to make no new investments in Putin's oil. As Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted, it strikes at the heart of Putin's war machine. So can you talk about this, how your professional life, your activist life as a Ukrainian environmental lawyer comes together now with what you have identified as the reasons for this war and what can be used to stop funding the Russian military and the Russian regime?
Yeah, thank you so much for that. And, I will tell through and explain a few initiatives that we've been taking over those days as a lawyers, as an activist, involving a lot of global organizations and communities to help us with. So the first one is campaign that I've been a part of organizing. It's called End Global Fossil Fuel Addiction That Feeds Putin War Machine. And within this campaign, we demand to European nation states, the U.S., Canada, China, India, Japan, South Korea, and all other importers of Russian oil and gas to stop fund Putin's war machine. And we, again, call on political deputies to stop the war and actually to divest all funds that have been invested and kept into Russian companies, Russian assets. And we also maintain, we also mentioned that Putin has deliberately weaponized fossil gas to increase his existing energy dominance over the European Union. And what we see, I can tell a bit later about another action within the European Union after amazing leadership of President Biden that you've mentioned, and how that continues over Europe and through Europe and European leaders. And Putin still threatens European nations that would come to Ukraine's aid, and this need to be stopped. So we called upon all governments of the countries I've mentioned outside Europe and inside the European Union to reject, ban, embargo any import of fossil fuels from Russia and rapidly phase out fossil fuels. Even, of course, realizing, because I am a researcher, I can understand climate change and easily navigate main provisions and main state of renewable energy development. So yes, it not seems to be easy, but that's quite possible, and it's a decisive point, as we pointed out with Bill McKibben in our LA piece. That has to be done to provide affordable access to distributed renewable energy for community-owned energy for everyone, and we should start now. This war is Such an immense tipping point, which we and a chance we might not have heard in the future, exactly as is with climate crisis. So therefore, we also demanded to stop all trade and end all investment in Gazprom, Rosneft, Transneft, Surgutneftgaz, Lukoil, Russian coal, and other Russian companies, and freeze the assets of such companies outside Russia, as well as freezing other Russian fossil fuel assets. And Western companies, as ExxonMobil, as others, have to stop fossil fuel production in Russia. So far, we said we collected 660 organization signatures into that from over 60 countries. And yesterday we've delivered with the campaign group Avaaz, we delivered the letters to all European leaders in the European Union and urged them to follow the example of President Biden and to put embargo on Russian oil and gas and end any investments into fossil fuels for their companies and banks. And also, I would like to mention a next very important Putin 100 campaign, which has been launched by in solidarity with Ukraine as well by over 75 organizations. Which we are writing to global banks, insurers, and asset managers that are most active in the Russian fossil fuel sector. These include JP Morgan Chase, Crédit Agricole, Citibank, Vanguard, Chubb, Lloyd's of London, and Munich Re. Groups are asking them to commit to not provide new financing, investment, insurance coverage, and other financial services to companies which make up the core of Russian coal, oil, and gas industry and divesting from existing assets. So there is a start of campaign you all can join. You can join our call to action, which is Stand With Ukraine, and you can also join campaign Putin's 100, which is has been launched within the U.S. and many global organizations in solidarity with Ukraine to stop this banking. Because I do remember one...
I just wanted to say, as you talk about stopping reliance on fossil fuel, the other part of this, the solution that you have stressed, is renewables. Earlier this week, President Biden banned oil and gas imports from Russia and called for a transition to green energy. This is what he said.
This crisis is a stark reminder. To protect our economy over the long term, we need to become energy independent. I've had numerous conversations over the last 3 months with our European friends of how they have to wean themselves off of Russian oil. It's just not tenable. It should motivate us to accelerate the transition to clean energy. This is a perspective, again, that our European allies share, and a future where together we can achieve greater independence.
So, Svetlana Romanko, you write in the L.A. Times, with an influx of funding, we could, for instance, produce air-source heat pumps by the million, ship them to Europe so by next winter they could be installed, heating homes and putting a noticeable dent in Putin's oil and gas leverage. These renewable solutions that you stress...
Yeah, these are renewable energy solutions beyond any doubt. And adding to that, I would like to say that the key and root prerequisite for those solutions to be put in place, to be implemented the soonest, and not allowing peace washing of fossil fuel companies to justify the increased exploration of fossil fuels. This should be also transformed into renewable energy transition. As a society, as an activist, we should not allow fossil fuel companies right now to increase their exploration. And these renewable energy solutions that you've mentioned are very true. They are affordable, and everyone basically can be a part of a network of implementing those solutions. That's why we call them distributed, community-owned, community-led solutions. But the root prerequisite, I would like to mention that we need to triple our investment in clean energy, which means we need to find the costs from somewhere. And there is enough.
Svetlana, we're going to have to break soon. We're going to be going to Mykolaiv, and you know that southern city is under siege. But I wanted to finally ask you about, one, I was surprised when you said you plan to go right back to your city that was just bombed today, that you plan to go back soon. And are you afraid about speaking out? I mean, you're a Ukrainian climate lawyer, can clearly be identified. What are the risks?
Yeah, I've seen some signs of risk. That's why I'm just trying to mitigate them. But I'm personally not afraid. I am not afraid. I'm only, of course, I should consider some risks for family and so on, but I am personally not afraid, and I am ready to, and I plan, I just really plan to, after some security measures, to go back to my country and to help. Because this is the country of my parents and where they are. This is the country where I was born, and I am a patriotic person, and I should go back and keep helping, even because everyone in our country is a volunteer right now. And together we can overcome the biggest evil which Putin represents with his war machine. We can stop this. I truly believe, and I have no fear.
Svetlana Romanko, I want to thank you so much for being with you. We are going to check back with you in the coming days. Ukrainian climate activist, longtime environmental lawyer, who lives in the western Ukrainian city of Ivano-Frankivsk. She founded the Stand with Ukraine campaign, calling on governments to ban trade and investment in Russian oil and gas. We'll link to the piece you wrote with Bill McKibben, "The Ukraine War is a Decision Point. Banks should stop funding the fossil fuel industry forever." Coming up, we go to the besieged southern Ukrainian city of Mykolaiv. And then we'll be speaking with Andrew Bacevich. Stay with us. Concerto for two keyboards in C minor featuring Alexander Malokhiv. Despite voicing opposition to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the young Russian pianist was struck from the schedule of the Montreal Symphony Orchestra this week. In a Facebook post, Malokhiv wrote, quote, "The most important thing now is to stop the blood. All I know is that the spread of hatred will not help in any way, but only cause more suffering." This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we go now to the besieged city of Mykolaiv in southern Ukraine. The sounds of Russian bombs exploding near the city of Mykolaiv in southern Ukraine. This is the city's mayor, Mykolaiv Alexander Sienkevich, speaking Tuesday following intense Russian rocket attacks.
Yesterday, they attacked the city with cluster rockets. You know that they are forbidden. So 64 buildings were attacked. I mean, civil buildings, people where people live. They damaged all those buildings, and let's say about 40 rockets were unexploded. So I think they launched for about more than 100 rockets to the city.
Many Ukrainian refugees have been fleeing the Mykolaiv region to escape the fighting. This is one woman from the area. Her name is Irina Mikhalenka, who was able to reach Romania.
We have a war, but we are not from Odessa. We came to Odessa from Mykolaiv region because there were very, very intense events there. We were hiding with my family in the basement, and Russian forces bombed so hard that sand was falling from the ceiling. And we were very scared, so we evacuated to the other side of the city. Also, when we were walking, the bridge was blown up. And when we crossed over the wreckage of the bridge, because there was no other way out, there were corpses of Russian soldiers soldiers lying there, and they were turned inside out.
We're joined now by Igor Yudenkov of Mykolaiv. Prior to the invasion, he was working as a project manager at an IT company in Kherson, which is now under Russian control. Igor, thank you so much for being willing to come on to Democracy Now! So you've got Russian-occupied Kherson now, and your own city under siege. The video we played was from you. Describe what's happening right now.
Hello, everyone who hear me. Right now, I am in Mykolaiv. On the border of our city, there is Russian troops. Even right now, when I am listening to you, and right now when I'm speaking with you, there is artillery and missile attack. Also, there was an air raid signal, but I stay with you to explain and to explain you what is happening today.
Igor, you are incredibly brave, and I just want to say thank you for speaking to us. But if there is any siren you hear or you feel you should go, you should go. So tell us what's happening every day.
Every day, my day is starting that I check all my friends, all my relatives, and all my colleagues from work, that everybody is alive. Also, the situation for me is hard because my family right now is also under occupied territory in Mykolaiv region. The situation is bad, but because there are some the problems begin with the food and water. But we have telephone talks, and I try to support them. But I have no tools how to help them, because they are full of Russian.
We just lost Igor for a minute. We're hoping that we'll be able to get him back.
Go ahead, Igor. You're with us.
Yes. And again, your wife and your daughter are separated from you at this point. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Because before it's when it started, I think that it will be more safety for them to stay in a countryside, not in a city, because for me, I was sure that they will bomb and they will hit all our cities, because it's their main aim to make fear for all Ukrainian nation.
So can you have been there helping other residents? Describe what you're doing, and even the footage that you sent us that we just played of the Russian attacks.
I right now helping. I am trying to work like a half part remote on my usual work, but also I try to help my own city in different ways. Many of our citizens left our city, and many pets and like domestic animals stay without stay alone. I also try to feed them when I have time and when I can find some food for them. Also, I help our like local defense with making box sends just to defend some streets or so on.
We were just communicating with some people who are helping families leave Mykolaiv. They leave, they then come back. How hard is it to come and go from Mykolaiv? And what about your access to food, to water, to electricity? Are people remaining in basements? I mean, in Mariupol, which is very near you, people are trapped. They cannot leave.
Okay. In Mykolaiv, the situation is better because we have a free bridge through the river, which connect us with the road to Odessa. It's like it's the bridge of a life, because through this bridge, food can come to our city. But it's about Nikolaev. But about Kherson, the situation is more harder, because most of the shops are occupied by Russian troops. They take from shops what they want, and there is no access for civilian to the shops, and also they fear because the Russian troops are armed with weapons.
What message do you want people in the rest of the world to hear as you speak from the besieged city of Mykolaiv?
For whole world, for whole democracy world, right now, here in Ukraine, we stop the invasion of Russian Putin troops. They won't attack only Ukraine. They won't attack whole democracy, democracy of our life, the freedom. Because Ukraine is a free country. We have a democracy election. We can have meetings. We can vote. But they didn't like it. They won't fight against freedom. From my point of view, I think that whole world need to help us here to stop their invasion. Right now, we have needs in air, body armor, helmets, and equipment. It is what is really, we don't have it in, there is some problems with this. And not of all our forces, our equipment, has such equipment.
Well, Igor, I want to thank you for being with us. We are going to check back with you in the coming days. Igor Yudenkov lives in Mykolaiv. He is volunteering there, where he's been helping other residents, also those who left their pets there, trying to care for them, get them some kind of sustenance. He's been separated from his wife and his daughter, who are currently in Russian-occupied territory in southern Ukraine. Before the Russian invasion, he was an IT professional. Next up, we're going to speak with the retired Colonel Andrew Basevich of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He says the United States cannot absolve itself of responsibility for the catastrophe in Ukraine. Stay with us. The way will be opening by Stereolab. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the U.S. Senate has passed a $1.5 trillion spending bill that includes $13.6 billion for military and economic aid for Ukraine. That
twice the original amount requested by the Biden administration. This comes as the U.S. and NATO are pouring weapons into Ukraine to help counter the Russian invasion. The New York Times recently reported the U.S. and its allies sent 17,000 anti-tank weapons to Ukraine over a recent six-day period. The Washington Post reported the U.S. is quietly preparing plans to back a Ukrainian insurgency and a government in exile if Russia succeeds in seizing Ukraine. We're joined now by Andrew Bacevich, president and co-founder of the anti-war think tank Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, retired colonel, Vietnam War veteran, professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University, author of a number of books, including his most recent just out called After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. His most recent pieces include one headlined, U.S. Can't Absolve Itself of Responsibility for Putin's Ukraine Invasion. Professor Bacevich, let's begin there. Talk about the U.S.-Putin connection and why you feel the U.S. is partially responsible for what's taking place.
Well, I think I would describe it as a U.S. Russia connection, because it's not necessarily limited to Mr. Putin. And the key issue here, I think, is when the Cold War ended. And when the Cold War ended, of course, Russia was in a position of great weakness and vulnerability. And the United States and its allies chose to exploit that weakness. The most vivid expression of that was the eastward expansion of NATO. Let's remind ourselves, NATO was an anti-Soviet alliance when it was created in 1949. Expansion of NATO basically moved it up to the borders of post-Soviet Russia. At that time, there were many Americans. George Kennan, the diplomat, would be perhaps the most prominent, that warned against NATO expansion as likely to cause us troubles down the road. We ignored those warnings, and I think that we're kind of in a chickens coming home to roost situation right here. Putin has, I am not a Putin apologist, and he's the principal cause of this catastrophe that we're experiencing. But Putin had been quite candid in warning that the eastward movement of NATO, and in particular the possibility of Ukraine joining NATO, constituted, from his perspective, a vital threat, a threat to vital Russian security interests. We ignored that, and I think to some degree this terrible, unnecessary war is a result of that.
Well, you know, you're not the only one who says this. One person who warned years ago about NATO expansion in Eastern Europe is William Burns, the current director of the CIA. He served as U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2005 to 2008. And in his memoir, The Back Channel, Burns wrote, quote, "Sitting at the embassy in Moscow in the mid-90s, it seemed to me that NATO expansion was premature at best and needlessly provocative at worst." And then in 1995, Burns wrote a memo saying, quote, "Hostility to early NATO expansion is almost universally felt across the domestic political spectrum here." He's talking about Russia. In another memo, Burns wrote, "Ukrainian entry into NATO is the brightest of all red lines for the Russian elite, not just Putin. In more than 2.5 years of conversations with key Russian players, from knuckle-draggers in the dark recesses of the Kremlin to Putin's sharpest liberal critics, I have yet to find anyone who views Ukraine and NATO as anything other than a direct challenge to Russian interests." Again, those the words of the current director of the Central Intelligence Agency, William Burns. Andrew Bacevich.
Well, so one would say that given that kind of warning from a very senior official, highly respected senior official, why did we go ahead and do it anyway? And I think there are two answers to that question. One is because Europeans so desperately wanted to join NATO and to join the EU, seizing their chance to have democracy, to have liberalism, to have the possibility of prosperity. You know, my paternal grandparents came from Lithuania. Lithuania was in the vanguard of countries that wanted to join the EU and NATO. I don't blame the Lithuanian people for that aspiration. And in many respects, joining NATO and the EU has paid dividends for Lithuania. That said, it was done in the face of objections by the Russians, and now we're paying the consequences of those objections. I think the other reason we did it, of course, apart from what I think is really kind of a deep-seated Russophobia that pervades many members of the American elite, was the belief at that time, that is to say, back in the 1990s, the belief that Russia couldn't do anything about it. Russia was weak, Russia was disorganized, and therefore it seemed to be a low risk proposition to exploit Russian weakness to advance our objectives and also to advance the objectives of other European countries, most of which had either been part of the Soviet Union or had been Soviet satellites and saw the end of the Cold War as their chance to achieve freedom and prosperity. I don't blame the Lithuanians. I don't blame the Poles. But I do think that American decision makers acted impetuously and indeed recklessly, and now we're facing the consequences.
Let's talk about this brutal invasion by Putin of Ukraine and also what Putin is demanding. It hasn't gotten as much attention in the United States as in other places, but the demands and written in documents submitted to the U.S., Ukraine cease military action, Ukraine change its constitution to enshrine neutrality, acknowledge Crimea as Russian territory, acknowledge Crimea. And if you can talk about these demands and also the brutality of what Putin is doing right now.
Well, let's start with the brutality. I must admit that to me, the most striking thing about the war as it has evolved has been the crudeness of the Russian war machine. They had portrayed themselves as a modern army. Modern armies know how to use force, to use violence in a controlled and purposeful way. Yeah, people get killed. Buildings get destroyed. But it's not random violence. That I think, summarizes the conception of modern war. And we believed, and I think the Russians themselves believed, that they had embraced the methods of modern war. It turns out that they did not. And so everything that has happened thus far over the first couple of weeks has demonstrated that they are incapable of using violence in a controlled and politically purposeful way, which brings us to the present moment where it appears that what we are moving into is some form of siege warfare, where violence is used in a random way to punish, to terrorize, I guess, among the Russian commanders, with some vague hope that violence used in this way is going to lead to the Ukrainians giving up, collapsing. It remains to be seen if that's going to happen. But that seems to be the current conception among the Russians of how they think they're going to achieve their goals. Whether or not they succeed, what we see, I think, is levels of violence far greater than anybody expected, the probability of civilian deaths and destruction on an enormous scale, and not insignificantly, at least from a Russian point of view, very high Russian casualties. The press reports that say that the Russians have already lost somewhere in the order of 3,000 to 4,000 Russian soldiers killed in action is actually, in my view, astonishing and is a powerful statement of how the Russians misread their own military capabilities and therefore plunged into this morass where I don't think anybody on the Russian side, whether Putin or his generals, has a clear picture of how they're going to get out of the mess that they created.
So they're calling for Ukraine talk about what it means to remain neutral, also recognition of Crimea and the independent states, the Donbas region. But I also wanted to quote Zelensky here for a minute, if we can see any movement in both of these parties when it will come to a ceasefire. He made this very important statement on ABC. He said, regarding NATO, I have cooled down regarding this question a long time ago after we understood that NATO is not prepared to accept Ukraine. Talk about what this means.
Well, it's too bad people couldn't say that out loud before the war started. I mean, I think
that was
based
Zelensky.
On what I hear. Pardon me?
That was Zelensky himself, the president of Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, but had Zelensky said, had the Americans said, had NATO said out loud prior to the beginning of the war that we all collectively recognized that Ukraine is not going to be joining NATO anytime soon. If we're willing to put that in writing, then I would argue that it would be at least have been possible, not certain, it might have been possible to dissuade Putin from taking the course that he chose. Again, he chose the course. He's the perpetrator. He's the criminal. But nonetheless, I think a wiser handling of the NATO issue might have given Putin a way to avoid taking the terrible steps that he ended up taking.
Zelensky also said, I'm talking about security guarantees, he said. He went on to say, I think that items regarding temporary occupied territories and unrecognized republics that have not been recognized by anyone but Russia, these pseudo-republics, but we can discuss and find a compromise on how these territories will live on. And this was followed by Ukraine's Foreign Minister Kuleba saying, if we could reach an agreement where a similar system of guarantees as envisaged by the North Atlantic Charter could be granted to Ukraine by the permanent members of the UN Security Council, including Russia, as well as by Ukraine's neighbors, this is something we're ready to discuss. I mean, we're seeing the broad outline of a possible agreement or ceasefire here.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that what you just quoted is courageous, enlightened, especially given the fact that Ukraine has been the victim of this entire thing. And I guess the question is, on the Russian side, are there any signs of that willingness to compromise? And that's where, not that I know anything about discussions going on behind the scenes, but it appears that Russia is not willing to seek a compromise. Quite frankly, if Putin listens to any advisors whatsoever, those advisors should be urging him to find a way to cut a deal, because the longer this war goes, the greater harm this war will inflict on Russia and the Russian people. Again, it's not my job to worry about Russia, but it seems to me if Putin cares at all about the well-being of his nation, then he needs to be working real hard to find a way to back away from the cliff that he's wandered onto.
Finally, Andrew Bacevich, if you can explain the argument you make in your piece, headlined "The Ukraine Invasion is Nothing Compared to Iraq." I mean, you're a retired colonel, you're a Vietnam War veteran, you lost your son in Iraq. Explain your argument.
Well, I mean, I don't—not for an instant would I want to minimize the horrors that are unfolding in Ukraine today. And the deaths and the injuries inflicted on noncombatants. But let's face it, the numbers are minuscule compared to the number of people that died, were displaced, were injured as a consequence of the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The total number, according to the Brown University Cost of War Project, the total number is somewhere in the vicinity of 900,000 deaths resulted from our invasion of Afghanistan and our invasion of Iraq. Now, I understand that Americans don't want to talk about that, don't want to remember that. The political establishment wants to move on from that. But there is, I think, a moral dimension to the present war, to the Ukraine war, that should cause us to be a little bit humble, reticent about pointing our fingers at other people.
Finally, we only have 30 seconds, but the response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine has been staggering. I mean, you've got not only the government response, of course, Putin has strengthened NATO beyond any NATO activist's wildest imaginings. The corporate response, all of these companies pulling out, the effect of all of this.
Well, it remains to be seen, but I think your point is basically correct. The negative response that Putin has elicited across around the world, not everywhere, but most places around the world, has been astonishing and heartening. But let's see. I think it remains to be seen what the policy effects are going to be.
We thank you so much for being with us. Andrew Bacevich, a retired colonel, Vietnam War veteran, president and co-founder of the anti-war think tank Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His latest book is After the Apocalypse.
You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and try, try and try. You'll succeed at last. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Persecution, you must bear. You've got to get your share. Got your mind set on a dream. You can get it, no harder to see now. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and try, try and try. You'll succeed at last. Will come your way, but the hotter the battle you see, it's the sweeter the victory. Now you can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and try, try and try. You'll succeed at last.